on the life of the individual, and leading to what he calls the divine life. So far, he has considered the effects that it would have on mind, life, and body. And before this, we are, he has considered this material effects in terms of matter, and effects in terms of the physical being of man. And the paragraph prior to the one in which we are, he has moved now to consider the whole issue of delight. So, supermind, in its gradual influence and manifestation in mind, life, and body, would do two things. One is, first, it would set each of these parts of the being in its right relation with other things. That is one of the functions of integration, so that there is a balance and a harmony between the different parts of mind and between mind and life and body, and similarly in each of these other parts. That would be one of its effects. Instead of interfering with each other and creating a jumbled action, there would be now a harmonious action led by a single integral power, integral Shakti. The other aspect would be, each part of our being, which now expresses only a fragment, a fraction of its capacity, would start manifesting its own supramental possibilities, which are latent in them. So that is how knowledge will become the natural possession of mental being, transformed mental being. A sense of vast creative will in union with all things, the natural action of the vital, the sense of, you know, power of empathy or sympathy with all things would be natural to the affective life. And as far as the body is concerned, first it would be enabled to progress in harmony with the other parts of the being, which now it finds so difficult because it is so compromised. And secondly, more and more, it will be yielded the protection to develop its own consciousness. And finally, it will be able to bear the intensities of the spiritual life and of every shock and every contact of the cosmos in a very plastic and pliable manner, so that it becomes part of the interacting life of the one being in the cosmos. So this is what he has considered so far. And having considered this, he now looks at certain other aspects of the supramental transformation, the supramental experience, subjective experience. What he is considering here, where we are, is the aspect of delight. And bring harmony and capacity to the instruments implies the action of Shakti and also the action of the power of unity. But along with this power of unity, there exists a profound, vast calm and quality and basing based in that quality, a power of delight. This power of delight is the very essence of existence. Because as we have seen, it is out of delight that every manifestation springs as a creative act without any need. So it is self, you know, creative delight, a delight of creation, which is behind everything. And hence, in our existence too, it is power of delight that guides the motives, all our various actions. There is an aspiration for delight in the mind, in the life, in the affect, in the will, in the body. So he goes through that in that paragraph just preceding the one in which we asked, and points out how, due to the lack of capacity, the lack of harmony, and the sense of separation from quote-unquote others, this power of delight becomes distorted. We can only experience a modicum of delight in any one of our instruments, beyond which it is felt to be its opposite, undelight, a capacity box beyond a certain point, very small spectrum of experience. Again, there is the sense of that which is ours and that which is not ours, which yields its character to our experience of delight. This comes from the natural aspect of separation which belongs to the ignorance. Finally, there is the problem of the lack of balance between the elements, which also yields its own dis-ease to our experience, our subjective experience of life, and hence of delight. So this very, yet every part of our being is moved by this need for delight. Now, he points out how these various kinds of experiences become, in some sense, modified and transformed by the supramental transformation. As the supramental transformation increases its effect, there is a greater capacity for delight, and in natural delight of existence that begins to manifest in all our being and our actions. So then he is talking about how that delight is intrinsic to existence, and how it is not by a need for it or a demand for it, but by a resting in the power of the consciousness of supermind that this delight can be experienced. From that he points out how indeed supermind itself is a supramental consciousness itself is an evolute from the power of delight. Our delight stands at the cusp of the manifestation of supermind, and therefore is supramental consciousness's instinct of delight. And when it establishes itself, one may say, it is really for the sake of a manifestation of delight that there is the manifestation of the supermind. The intermediate plane of the supermind, which establishes unity, harmony, and truth in the cosmos, or which we could also say which establishes the cosmos of unity, harmony, and truth, becomes really the basis for the manifestation of a cosmos of delight, a play of delight. So that is what he brings out over here in this paragraph we have just finished. And I would like to read the last few lines there. All lives in the being of Gnosis, in the life of the Gnosis, some power of the Ananda would be there as an inseparable and pervading significance of the supramental self-experience. In the liberation of the soul from the ignorance, the first foundation is peace, calm, the silence and quietude of the eternal and infinite. But a consummate power and a greater formation of spiritual ascension takes up this peace of liberation into the bliss of a perfect experience and realization of the eternal beatitude, the bliss of the eternal and infinite. This Ananda would be inherent in the Gnostic consciousness as a universal delight and would grow with the evolution of the Gnostic nature. This part is also related to what Sri Aurobindo calls Ananda Brahman. In the record of yoga, this aspect relates to Brahma Chatushtha and its fourth power, which is Ananda. Brahma Chatushtha, it is very clear that establishment of equality, of perfect peace, is the basis, necessary basis, without which delight of Brahma cannot be experienced. And he point out that this is because every other kind of delight is a delight of need. But it is intrinsic delight of infinite self-existence that constitutes the Brahman's Ananda, Ananda of Brahman. And therefore, it is only by the eradication of this need and the establishment of supermind that true spiritual Ananda may be experienced in the manifestation. Now, in this next paragraph, we'll point out how there is a misconception regarding the relation between peace and delight. There are various schools that, sort of downplay the power of delight. And one may also talk of alternate schools that overplay the power of delight, that aim for a kind of ecstasy in which there is a certain type of ready access to some kind of trance of delight. But what he's pointing out here is that is not the spiritual delight that supermind brings. Supermind automatically brings the delight of Brahman through the establishment of a power of being to which delight is intrinsic. So this is something that is very important in understanding the relationship of delight and gnosis.
So,
I think Sitaram was asking, did I hear eradication of need? Yeah, eradication of need, that is right. In the sense that, as that paragraph, last paragraph that we did last time, the one before, the one we'll start today, he points out how human existence is driven by a need for delight. At every level of the being, and this is natural because it is out of delight that the existence has come. So, because we are in the ignorance, we experience a limited existence, and an existence which is one of struggle. Therefore, our experience of delight also takes the form of a need for delight, a need which is marked also by the same lack, the lack of separation, the lack of disbalance or disharmony, and the lack of capacity. See? So that's why he starts that paragraph by saying, an aspiration, a demand for the supreme and total delight of existence is there secretly in the whole make of our being. But it is disguised by the separation of our parts of nature and their differing urge, and obscured by their inability to conceive or seize anything more than a superficial pleasure. So then he goes on to talk about how this mind, life and body. But the point he's making is that it is only when this need, obscure need, which is experienced as a mind drive, rajasic drive, or a kind of a thirst, insatiable thirst in the being, when this can be brought under the control of the supramental instinct, that this changes its character from a character of need for delight to a character of the experience of the delight of being as an intrinsic quality of being. That is the point.
Thank you, Dhamishta. I was thinking, so as long as you don't embody it, typically that is true with any other need, right? Like you feel the need when you don't experience that reality.
Yeah, that is true also. Even if you, naturally, you're quite right. But even if you experience a partial factor, it is really a difference in kind from the delight of Brahman. Because delight of Brahman does not have any need to it. You're quite right. It is due to the absence that the need is there. But even if the need captures some light, you know, some fragment or fraction of that reality, still it is not the, you know, reality in kind. There is a difference in kind, not only in degree. Because in degree, you may say that if I get more, then I will be satisfied. The difference in kind means it is totally lacking in the very sense of need, because it is an intrinsic property of being. Because it is a sign of truth that it has no need to it. That is the point.
It is, I know it is not an exact comparison, but it is like artha jignasa distinction. The one who is craving for the God for the need of something,
right?
And the jignasu is the one who is better than artha and artharthi. Artha is the lowest who is seeking. Artha is in need of something, and then jignasu is really wants divine for divine
sake. Actually, not really. You are making good point, Sita. In that distinction you are talking about from the Gita, he talks about four types of seekers. The first one he talks about is artha, or the one that sorrows, the one that is disappointed or dissatisfied with life, and therefore seeks for the divine. You are right, there is a certain need to it, an emotional need. There is arthati, which is a sense of lack at the material level. So there is a material need. You have a material need. The second case, you have a vital need, that is the artha. In the third case, jigyasu, there is a mental need, that is the mental curiosity, the thirst to know. That is also a need. Against these three, he is positing the jnani. And idea of jnani in Gita, he's saying, he who I love best is the jnani. The idea of jnani in Gita is not one who is seeking for knowledge, or thirsting for knowledge, but who wants to know the integral reality of the divine. That wanting to know the integral reality of the divine can only effect itself through asking the divine to reveal his own reality. See, that is what Arjuna is doing. When Arjuna says, show me who you are. In the truth of your being, that is jnana. Jnana is integral knowledge. Integral knowledge cannot come by seeking through thirst or through need. It can only come by receptivity and revelation. So that is the way in which, in that particular section that you are talking about in the Gita, material, vital and mental need is contrasted against integral knowledge. This is how I understand that. Now it relates to what you
said. Thank you, Devrishi. I have one more question regarding delight of the existence. How to practice that or how to make it a daily experience, translate that to your daily routine. What's the best way to do that? Can you give any directions or hints about that? How to practice?
Yeah, he is saying over here, Sita, that the practice of that is resting on the practice of peace. This is quite interesting because normally we would think, and in fact the paragraph we are going to study now will make that even clearer. Normally we would think that there should be a different kind of practice for establishing that power of delight. But he's saying, as we grow in oneness and oneness, the supramental influence enters into us. And delight is part of its intrinsic being. So we start experiencing that. Mind experiences delight of knowledge. The emotional life experiences delight of oneness and sympathy. The will experiences delight of creative action. Body experiences delight of the divine in every in contact of life. So these kinds of experiences of delight arise through development of the power of equality as a side effect rather than a active seeking. But in Samatha Chatushtaya, he adds to that power of surrender to the divine, what he calls nati. If power of surrender is there at every level of the being, capacity for delight grows. Because one then feels as if it is the divine who is bringing every experience to us. And that enhances the power of delight.
Very true. Thank you. I think I just want to bring in the way Krishna puts it in the second chapter is that he concludes it with saying something like Ashantasya Kutas Sukham. Without exactly, probably that translates into if you are not at peace, cannot experience any form of delight.
Absolutely. And then the corollary of that is, with the peace comes delight. So that is the one that he is pointing out, that you know the gradations of the establishment of Ananda Brahma proceeds from Samatha through Sukham to Samatha, Sukham, Shanti to Ananda.
Thank you. That gradation, that question is also very beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah. So talking of this pervading Ananda, so when Sri Aurobindo was doing the yoga himself, like when attempting the bringing down the supermind in especially the later part, the 1926 onwards, so during that time, is this Ananda something that's in his background, or is that all pervading even as he makes this effort, or is that something that's been put into the background we can speculate at this point only, I guess, but what would you say?
No, I'd say that definitely that Ananda is well established in him at that point. Because you see that 1926, with what is known as the overmental transformation, mm-hmm. even at the very point, the power of unity, the power of oneness was completely established in him. And that sense of delight, that power of delight was, you know, being experienced by him in a very concrete manner. It's not just speculation, because the record of yoga carries many notations about this. He's developing in a very systematic way all these various powers of delight. Now, we said that power of delight is not something to seek in its separate way before the establishment of supramental equality. But as a matter of fact, he is talking about all these various kinds of delight. Even in the very body, there are seven kinds of delight. And then there are what he calls the subjective delight. So there are, or maybe five delights, I don't remember. There are five, I think, gradations of ananda in the body. And then there are various other, you know, forms of ananda, at least six forms of ananda beyond that, which he calls the subjective ananda. So each one of them is actually clearly given a certain place, and he is developing them in the sense of, you know, experiencing their constant uninterrupted flow in his experience, in his being. So that is something that is remarkable, because he is talking about, you know, interruption and constancy of these forms of bliss in his waking existence.
Yeah. Thank you, Devashishda. The other thing that I wanted to say, I mean, just some housekeeping, is that I think there's a lot of background noise today compared to usual. Is this just me, or is it, Sitaram, are you feeling it too? Or?
I don't hear any background noise.
Oh, then it must just be me. It's okay. Okay.
Yeah, it sounds good for us too.
Okay, it might just be me. Fine, thanks.
Actually, I know it is mom relation, but... Ananda being having a physical or material type of nature to it, I think we see that these things like laughing therapy and others, where you explicitly go there, go to a place to laugh and experience. Do they have a basis in this type of things, like to create an atmosphere of laughter, and that automatically has certain healing power and all that? And
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. We'll have to reflect on that. But I can see what you're saying in terms of a kind of a, you know, forced physical practice, trying to establish a certain kind of ananda. Now, one certainly can talk about that, you know, you're talking about that as a kind of a, at the level of a physical being. One can also talk about subjective anandas like that, where, for example, very simple saying, for example, the mother makes, saying, be happy, you know, one can practice it. One can constantly practice just being happy, in the sense that we can wish away all the various kinds of negative feelings, thoughts, sense of dissatisfaction, etc., and keep the power of happiness active in the consciousness. In fact, through that, the psychic being is kept close to the front. So that sort of practice one can also talk about, but these practices are not foolproof. They are kind of like just like the power of visualization, which can be a crutch to some extent. All these injunctions are provisional and can only go to some degree without the developing a power of being, which is more and more, you know, experiences this intrinsically. That is, its intrinsic experience, rather than a practice.
Yeah, the thing is, it leads to the broader question of, you know, like the common habit of, you know, trying to simulate the result to get the cause, You know, like you see that even in the, like we keep reading about, like these are the properties of the psychic, these are the properties of the inner being. So we try to simulate that, and then we think that it, like we can fool ourselves into thinking that that is the psychic flame, whereas it's really more of that we have simulated the end result, right?
I agree. It is actually, it's really interesting, because it is to the extent that one has already had that experience, that these things mean something much more powerful. If one hasn't had the experience, then these things are just simulations.
Mm-hmm.
You see, even simulations can have some partial power,
sure,
but those are not foolproof, and they can't really get us beyond a certain, you know, provisional advance of progress.
Got it, yeah.
So in a way, you are not just what your beliefs are or what your visualization is. You are a lot more than that, right? So
like you were talking about laughter therapy, ultimately he's pointing to, I mean, the height of that condition of samatha chatusaya, final siddhi bhasya is laughter in the world. That laughter is not something which is kind of, you know, physically being manifested as laughter necessarily. One may not laugh at all, but it is as if one is experiencing the power of this tremendous laughter, which is the delight we were discussing this, I think, last time, or what, at some time, the delight of the gods.
Yes.
Which is, you know, something which sees in all things a tremendous power of wonder, because there is freedom in it. One is not trapped by any kind of dissatisfaction or lack or, you know, absence. There is total freedom which is being experienced at every moment in everything. Every experience is an experience out of that freedom. Therefore, it can only be an experience of bliss. That power of bliss is what is referred to as hastya, is that laughter.
Luis, would you like to start reading?
Okay. It has been held that ecstasy is a lower and transient passage. The peace of the supreme is the supreme realization, the consummate abiding experience. This may be true on the spiritual mind plane. The first ecstasy felt is indeed a spiritual rapture, but it can be and is very usually mingled with the supreme happiness of the vital parts taken up by the spirit. There is an exaltation, excitement, a high intensity of the joy of the heart and the pure inner soul sensation. It can be a splendid passage or an uplifting force, but is not the ultimate permanent foundation. But in the highest sense of the spiritual bliss, there is not this vehement exaltation and excitement. There is instead an illimitable intensity of participation in an internal ecstasy which is founded on the internal existence and therefore on a beatific tranquility of eternal peace. Peace and ecstasy cease to be different and become one. The supermind, reconciling and fusing all differences as well as all contradictions, brings out this unity. A wide calm and a deep delight of all existence are among the first steps of self-realization, but this calm and this delight rise together as one state into an increasing intensity and culminate in the eternal ecstasy, the bliss that is the infinite. In the Gnostic consciousness at any stage, there would be always in some degree this fundamental and spiritual conscious delight of existence in the whole depth of the being, but also all the movements of nature would be pervaded by it, and all the actions and reactions of the life and the body. None would escape the law of Ananda. Even before the Gnostic change, there can be a beginning of this fundamental ecstasy of being translated into a manifold beauty and delight. In the mind, it translates into a calm of intense delight of spiritual perception and vision and knowledge. In the heart, into a wide or deep or passionate delight of universal union and love and sympathy and the joy of beings and the joy of things. In the will and vital parts, it is felt as the energy of delight of a divine life power in action or beatitude of the senses perceiving and meeting the one everywhere, perceiving as their normal esthesis of things, a universal beauty, and a secret harmony of creation of which our mind can catch only imperfect glimpses or rare supernormal sense. In the body, it reveals itself as an ecstasy pouring into it from the heights of the spirit and the peace and bliss of a pure and spiritualized physical existence. A universal beauty and glory of being begins to manifest. All objects reveal hidden lines, vibrations, powers, harmonic significances concealed from the normal mind and the physical sense. In the universal phenomenon is revealed the eternal Ananda.
Are you there, Devashita?
Sorry about that. I think I was muted. I was saying that in this paragraph, he begins by talking about this more preliminary kind of delight or ecstasy that is closer to what is usually called religious exaltation. A religious exaltation or excitement often comes as a certain type of a vital phenomenon. It's a phenomenon of the excitement of the vital when there is a contact with something higher, of a higher intensity and power. This is what makes people, for example, in conditions of religious singing or dancing, sort of has this sense of heightened ecstasy. Now, what he's pointing out is that kind of experience is not a settled one. It is not the experience of the bliss of Brahman. So the bliss of Brahman is something that is can only be experienced in a settled condition. So, this is the reason why in religious traditions, these experiences are usually considered to be of a lower grade and only transitional to a condition of perfect peace. But what he's pointing out over here is that that condition of peace that overpasses these kinds of experiences of exaltation or a slippage into the trance of ecstasy are also experiences which contain a higher quality of delight in there. So he's saying that there is no need to distinguish a certain kind of a higher peace from the experiences of the of ecstasy, but that there is a power of ecstasy which is inherent to a higher established supramental peace. So this is what he then develops, talking about the fact that as the supramental consciousness establishes itself, peace and ecstasy cease to be different and become one. So this is a wide, calm, and deep delight of all existence among its first steps of self-realization. This calm and this delight rise together as one state into an increasing intensity and culminate in the eternal ecstasy. That is the hastya condition that we were talking about. Now, he then points out that this has two aspects to it. One is an intrinsic delight of being, as we were discussing, the Ananda Brahman. And then also this delight translates itself into nature at every level of its experience and action. And so that translation into all the movements of nature would be pervaded by it, and all the actions and reactions of the life and the body. Those are the various anandas that I was talking about that he mentions in the record of yoga. Each one of those five kinds of physical ananda and seven kinds of subjective ananda are the various forms of this delight translated into nature. Then he points out that as something even working from behind the surface, even before the full establishment of the delight of being, there can start being experienced at various levels of the being these anandas. So he gives descriptions of how in the mind, for example, with the establishment of a certain degree of silence, in the inner mind, the quality of thinking changes and becomes this impression, perception of the truth of things. This has delight intrinsic to it. It's almost as if one looking at the one, that kind of quality starts entering into the various aspects of nature. Similarly, with the existence of the heart, as you say, you know, the emotional being starts experiencing this sense of a perception of sympathy or empathy with all things. That is what he calls premananda in the record of yoga. That very wide and vast sense of a universal love that sees by sympathy its own quality in other things. Then he talks about the will, and he says how they start entering into the will, this energy of delight, of a divine life power in action. This is in the level of karma. And a beatitude of the senses, so that is chittananda, perceiving and meeting the one everywhere, perceiving as a normal aesthesis of things, a universal beauty and secret at the level of the senses, there is that particular experience. And finally, in the body, you have all those five kinds of delight, which are coursing through the body, coming from a higher level, and ecstasy pouring into it from the heights of the spirit, and the peace and bliss of a pure and spiritualized physical existence. So these are the various experiences that start establishing themselves by degrees, but can only complete themselves with the settlement of the supramental consciousness in being. And then he points to how all around, you know, our perceptions open up to new powers of beauty and delight in all things. It is as if the world reveals itself in a new way, which is the eternal wonder of the divine being at play in the universe. In the record of yoga, he mentions these anandas. If you wish, I can look for the various anandas that he mentioned.
Sure. I can just read the book.
This paragraph looks the one which we, two paragraphs before where we, which we read last week, right? He talked about this exaltation and
right.
Very similar
to that. Actually, we had read this paragraph last time. But I don't know whether we discussed it. So it's good that we are having this experience again. Now, here in the record, he actually you know, talks about forms of ananda in the nature. So the ananda of being is part of Brahma Chatusha, and that is called Ananda Brahman.
Uh-huh.
So that is intrinsic experience of bliss of being. But in nature, over there, he talks about these various forms of delight that ultimately don't belong only to mind, life, and body, but go beyond mind into the higher ranges of existence as well. Because in this fullness of the experience, one exists all the way from Satchidananda down to the physical. So there, these are the anandas, I read them out. First he says, this experience is the experience of bhukti, or enjoyment. Bhukti is the delight of existence in itself, independent of every experience and extending itself to all experiences. That is the delight of being, Ananda Brahma. But it also has three forms. Firstly, rasa grahanam, taking the rasa in the mind, bodily sensations, food, events, feelings, and thoughts. In all these experiences, there is a certain kind of experience of delight that is being taken. Secondly, bhoga in the prana, bhoga without kama, enjoyment without desire in the life being. Finally, the various forms of delight in the nature. These are physical ananda, that is the one he's talking about regarding those various flows, the flow of ananda in the body, that is called kama ananda, physical ananda. That has got five types to it. Then there is prema ananda. That is the one that I mentioned about the emotional being feeling by sympathy the power of delight of itself everywhere. Getting delight by positive feeling of love for all things. Then there is a certain delight in the mind which is without any cause, causeless. In the manas, ahetuka ananda, without cause. Then there he moves into supermind. And there is ananda of the chit in the object full of the gunas, chit ghana ananda, in vijnana. Then in ananda plane itself, there is shuddha ananda, the perception of beauty everywhere, that is in the ananda plane, shuddha ananda. Then ananda of pure consciousness without any gunas, chit ananda. Finally, ananda of pure existence apart from all objects and experiences, sadananda. So these are all the various of the delight that he mentions in the record of yoga.
Devasita, where are you reading this from in the record of yoga?
Oh, I'm reading it from, part 2, book 2,
okay.
Record of Yoga, book 2, page 1481.
1481. Yeah, thank you. Shall I read the next one?
Sure.
These are the first major results of the spiritual transformation that follow as a necessary consequence of the nature of supermind. But if there is to be not only a perfection of the inner existence, of the consciousness, of an inner delight of existence, but a perfection of the life and action, two other questions present themselves from our mental viewpoint, which have, to our human thought about our life and its dynamisms, a considerable, even a premier importance. First, there is the place of personality in the Gnostic being. Whether the status, the building of the being, will be quite other than what we experience as the form and life of the person or similar. If there is a personality, and it is in any way responsible for its actions, there intervenes next the question of the place of the ethical element and its perfection and fulfillment in the Gnostic nature. Ordinarily, in the common notion, the separative ego is ourself. And if ego has to disappear in the transcendental or universal consciousness, personal life and action must cease. For the individual disappearing, there can only be an impersonal consciousness, a cosmic self. But if the individual is altogether extinguished, no further question of personality or responsibility or ethical perfection can arise. According to another line of ideas, the spiritual person remains, but liberated, purified, perfected in nature in a celestial existence. But here we are still on earth, and yet it is supposed that the ego personality is extinguished and replaced by a universalized spiritual individual who is the center and power of the transcendent being. It might be deduced that this Gnostic or supramental individual is a self without personality, an impersonal Purusha. There could be many Gnostic individuals, but there would be no personality. All would be the same in being and nature. This again would create the idea of a void or blank of pure being, from which an action and function of experiencing consciousness would arise. But without a construction of differentiated personality, such as that which we now observe and regard as ourselves on our surface. But this would be a mental rather than a supramental solution of the problem of a spiritual individuality, surviving ego and persisting in experience. In the supermind, consciousness, personality and impersonality are not opposite principles. They are inseparable aspects of one and the same reality. This reality is not the ego, but the being, who is impersonal and universal in his stuff of nature, but forms out of it an expressive personality, which is his form of self in the changes of nature.
So we see that now Sri Aurobindo is coming from experience of being to life and action. That is, given the condition of a transforming force, what is the subjective experience of that is what he has considered so far. But now he's looking at, is a life possible from such a experience? And what would be the nature of such a life? So for us, as existence in the ignorance, the basis of life rests in the individual. And the individual, knowing itself as separate, provides a certain kind of distinguishing feature by which variation can be expressed and a play of life exists in the world. A question he's asking is, in this change that we're talking about, the supramental existence, this one being establishing itself in the individual, what is going to happen to the personality, and is there going to be any sense of right and wrong, or is there any understanding of ethics? What would it be in the individual? The first possibility he's taking up is related to the notion that whole idea of spiritual existence is erasure of personality. That in a sense, personality itself is a trap. That is, that we are someone, a separative being, an ego, and that is what binds us to a life of limitation. And that limitation is the prison house of repeating lives here on earth. So if we are to escape from that, we can experience this one existence, and we can have the subjective delight of that existence. But in that experience, there is no ego. The ego completely drops off. Along with it, we could conceive that the personality completely gets obliterated, and there is no place either for a personality or for a separate action or play among others. So there is no necessity for a play. This experience ultimately is completely subjective and waits only for the dropping of the body to disappear. There is no distinguishing or differentiating quality and no sense of action within it. Now, on the other hand, he is pointing to the possibility that one may not necessarily disappear in any state. One may continue to act in the world, but without any distinguishing personality. In other words, it's almost like a world of clones. There is just the same being that is being manifest in different sort of persons. And these different persons have nothing to distinguish them from each other. This is a mental or logical solution to this power of oneness that the supermind holds. But, you know, even earlier in this Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo has pointed out to the basis of the manifestation being what he calls the multiple self-concentration of the Divine. So in other words, if there is this unitary consciousness, this consciousness is also infinite, and its infinity is experienced by it in infinite ways. This infinite self-concentration creates various possibilities of being of the same one. And so, as he points out in Supermind, there doesn't need to be any contradiction between personality, impersonality, and universality. Supermind consciousness, personality, and impersonality are not opposite principles. They are inseparable aspects of one and the same reality. This reality is not the ego, but the being, who is impersonal and universal in its stuff of nature, but forms out of it an expressive personality, which is his form of self in the changes of nature. Now, it does this in two ways, or through two polarities. The very possibility of a self-concentration, infinite or multiple self-concentration of the one, means that the one can perceive of itself in multiple ways. Each one of these ways is like a blueprint. That blueprint ultimately carries the entire infinity of the one within it, but it's a certain perspective on itself. This constitutes the upper differentiating nature of the individual, what is known as the Jivatma. But there is also another way by which it forms a personality, a soul personality, what is known as the psychic being. And it does this by actually plunging into nature and taking different molds of nature for its self-expression, creating, therefore, a certain kind of a matrix of possibilities in nature through which it acts. That is the soul personality. Now, this soul personality or psychic being is something which at this stage that he's talking about has merged into its own supramental, you know, total possibility. In that condition, it loses its distinguishing nature as a limited personality or a persona, a mask of God. But at the same time, it still maintains a certain play of differentiation, personality, as he says over here. That is, it is at once impersonal and personal, at once infinite and finite. There is that kind of paradox which marks the existence of the individual expressing it through supernatural life. This is the only way in which a play of difference, unity in difference, can take place in a supernatural manifestation.
Devishishta, I was, while reading this paragraph, I was trying to read Sri Aurobindo's life itself into this, which was, to me, it looks like last few sentences look very much like autobiographical.
Sure.
And actually, I got the question related to personality and instrumentality. At some point, we border on impersonality, it is more like instrumentality, correct? You are being a channel to a particular universal universal force, you are being an instrument. So basically, we can kind of read that as an instrumentality, correct?
True. So here, there is a certain power of instrumentality, as you say, power to channel the universal forces but also a personality which is very flexible. Yet it has a certain kind of nature formation, which gives a certain kind of, you know, definition. But there is a certain quality to it. There is a qualitative, you know, body to it. And yet the qualitative body is so pliable that it can express the universal forces, the supplemental forces that are passing through it. It's quite interesting that this whole thing about impersonality and personality, because you find that in the case of even the some of the, even if you're talking about Sri Aurobindo, but you can even think about some of the other great spiritual personalities, you know, that there is a certain kind of commonality among them. You can sense this profound peace, for example, this presence of the self, the universal being. Say, if you take somebody like Raman Maharshi, you take somebody like Vivekananda, you sense that power of the Ishvara, of the Purusha, in all these beings, and yet there is a distinct personality there. There is something that is impersonal and personal at the same time. That, I think, is something that gives us a good handle on what he's talking about here.
So, if we were to take not so much in the spiritual leaders type of examples, but more like vibhutis of certain types, like if you look at that, there is this sense of peace might be missing, but they are instruments. So, it's contrary is not true. Like, correct, if you are being a perfect instrument of something, doesn't mean you embody the paradox, correct?
Yeah, but you know something, it's a very good point, and I think he's going to touch on that point also in one of the paragraphs over here, that the vibhuti, you know, what is really remarkable about the vibhuti is the fact that people sense something universal in them. That there is a power which is, may not be just peace, but there is a power which is much greater than normal individual human being, almost sign of the divine, that is there in them. Usually because the personality has not lost its limitation, there is a double existence. One can sense the ego existence of some puppet mass, but also one can sense behind it something which is superhuman, a divine. So this coexistence is what usually marks the vibhuti. If, however, that the limitation of the ego fell away, then they would also express as instruments that same kind of power of the divine, you know, depending on the totality, the manifestation of the, you know, of the swabhava and swadharma. How integral is it that would, you know, then determine to what extent a certain supramental power can express personality and personality at the same time.
While embodying this nature, there is implicit, evolution, basically taking the evolution forward is built into this taking a form, right? That is, that purpose, that strong purpose is it there with just being an instrument?
Not necessarily. Instrument, that's the reason why Vibhuti may not even be somebody who's evolutionary. Vibhuti could be a peak, I mean, that there are examples like that that Sri Aurobindo and the mother have given, beings who may come even for a very few of even one lifetime as a kind of a instrument to carry out some cosmic purpose. But of course, that is rare and extraordinary. Usually, both these things do coexist. There is a evolutionary kind of, you know, taking up of nature, that is going on at the same time behind the screen, there is the action of some higher divine force or personality.
In this paragraph, Aurobindo is not giving any weightage to this void type of completely impersonal type of existence. So a lot of traditional schools and the people try to give weightage to, right? Like, for example, people, it's a very romantic notion to be almost seen as a pinnacle of achievement, to be a void, right?
Yeah, you're right. You're right, and that's actually exactly what he's contesting over here. Because, you see, one of the things that's usually seen, this also has a cultural kind of aspect to it, that if you think about the Eastern traditions, whether Far Eastern or even Indian, of course in India you have a tremendous variety of these forms of spiritual experience and existence, but there is a general trend, as you mentioned, to think of it or speak of spiritual becoming to be this kind of void, personality-less, erasure of personality, one may say. But on the other hand, if one looks culturally, one finds that notion of the self, notion of the individual has been given a tremendous amount of priority in Western cultures. Now, Sri Aurobindo unites these two and sees that for a play of life, you need the differentiation of the person. So, person or individual has a basis. And that's why, I mean, in Life Divine, he first foregrounds the person in Book 1, in chapter on the divine soul. So, he's pointing out this fact that individual has a necessity if life is to manifest the divine. And that's why there is no the whole ideal of erasing personality and sort of there being no individuality or there being no personality at all in the manifestation is a condition in which there can be no play of life. That's the point he's making over here, that there is some divine aspect to that as well. That divine aspect lies in the fact that the divine being is infinite and multiple and comes in each of us in a certain way, but does not cease to be infinite or impersonal in every personality.
I think there is this notion that, basically, it is like you are like a fragrance. The fragrance of spirituality will permeate itself into the universe, and one will become a spiritual sun, and affect the evolution in illimitable ways. That was that their personality is completely erased, and that is kind of. I've heard that type of expressions where there is no personality, but this is the way it works. That is the explanation given for impersonal type of experience as the ultimate experience. This is the justification.
Yeah, there also, Sitaram, what you're talking about, being a fragrance only, it is like the description of the flower that in itself does not know its beauty but is manifesting naturally that beauty because that is all that it can do. It is the divine in that particular form. So, you know, there again we find that you can give that description that you gave and still assert personality without ego. Ego is gone, but personality is still there. Divine Purusha can manifest in every existence in a unique manner without that existence, thinking of itself as limited, it naturally expresses that divine without necessarily being, you know, conscious of itself as something separate.
Thank you. I think the extra emphasis on eradication of the personality that what people go through, I think that is the thing that needs to be looked into, I think.
Exactly. I completely agree. I think the difficulty comes in being able to distinguish between an egoless existence and a personalityless existence. Personality can exist without ego. And that's the point that he's making, that in the supermind, impersonality and personality are not opposites. They can coexist. Ego goes away. So there isn't that sense of a separate mask that I am something different from others. That is not there. But at the same time, it is the divine that is at play in specific ways in every being or through every being.
Sitaram, do you want to read next?
Impersonality is in its source something fundamental and universal. It is an existence, a force, a consciousness that takes on various shapes of its being and energy. Each such shape of energy, quality, power or force, though still in itself general, impersonal and universal, is taken by the individual being as material for the building of his personality. Thus, impersonality is in the original undifferentiated truth of things, the pure substance of nature of being, the person, in the dynamic truth of things. It differentiates its powers and lends them to constitute by their variations the manifestation of personality. Love is the nature of the lover. Courage is the nature of the warrior. Love and courage are impersonal and universal forces or formulations of the cosmic force. They are the spirit's powers of its universal being and nature. The person is the being supporting what is thus impersonal, holding it in himself as his nature of self. He is that which is the lover and warrior. What we call the personality of the person is his expression in nature status and nature action. He himself being in his self-existence, originally and ultimately, much more than that. It is the form of himself that he puts forth as his manifested already developed natural being or self in nature. In the form limited individual, it is his personal expression of what is impersonal. His personal appropriation of it, we may say so, to have a material with which he can build a significant figure of himself in manifestation. In his formless, unlimited self, his real being, the true person or Purusha, he is not that, but contains in himself boundless and universal possibilities, but he gives to them as the divine individual his own turn in the manifestation, so that each among the many is a unique self of the one divine. The divine, the eternal, expresses himself as existence, consciousness, bliss, wisdom, knowledge, love, beauty, and we can think of him as this impersonal and universal powers of himself. Regard them as the nature of the divine and eternal. We can say that God is love, God is wisdom, God is truth or righteousness, but he is not himself, an impersonal state or abstract of states or qualities. He is the being, at once absolute, universal and individual. If we look at it from this basis, there is very clearly no opposition, no incompatibility, no impossibility of a coexistence or one existence of the impersonal and the person. They are each other, live in one another, melt into each other, yet in a way can appear as if different ends, sides, observe and reverse of the same reality. The Gnostic being is of the nature of divine and therefore repeats in himself this natural mystery of existence.
So this is, he's clarifying exactly what we were discussing. And this is, of course, an old, one of those conundrums or puzzles of, as he says, a mystery of existence. In the Western philosophies, this is considered as the sort of relationship between what is known as the who and the what. The who and the what. The what is these qualities. Can we define existence through the play of qualities? Can we say that certain principles are at play and human beings, like you said, mentioned Sitaram, are instruments of these various impersonal qualities that are at play? But at the same time, there is a notion of the who, that is the person. And then each of these are irreducible. That is, there is a sense of person which is irreducible. Once one goes sufficiently into the heart of existence, one gets the sense of a person, a being, as he says, that is both the originator and the instrument of these impersonal forces. Impersonal forces, the what, are qualities of being, but being is ultimately a who. So this is the reason why Brahman is also characterized as having primary, forms of approach. You can approach Brahman as Purushottama, supreme person, or Paramatman, supreme self. See, these aspects of Brahman are testimony to the irreducibility of a person. So just like that, there is a person aspect to every Gnostic being, to every manifestation of Gnostic being. There is a certain reproduction of the Supreme Person. Now that sense of person, of the who, is something which is illimitable. As he's saying, it contains all these powers within it. And yet, irreducibly, there is the sense of a person to it. Moreover, this person knows how to configure its own reality so that there may be a unique self-presentation or self-representation in nature. And out of that self-representation arises a personality which becomes the basis of a play of the infinite. The what coming through the who in a specific and unique form in the play of the universe. So this is the point he's making, that each Gnostic being is the one being, the supreme being. But at the same time, it is the supreme being that is modulating itself to certain specific nature forms to create this play in the universe. However, as he'll point out, the normal existence, supramental existence or the transformed existence, there is a difference. The difference lies in the fact that not only is ego a subjective experience of separation and limitation, but also there is a certain degree, a great degree of limitation of personality in the mask that one puts on. So even if the ego is something that can be overcome in the spiritual existence, which is not yet supramental, that integrality will be missing. While what he's talking about over here is the Gnostic being, in whom not only is there the ego has disappeared, but even in the uniqueness of the personality, totality or integrality of the person can manifest itself. Though there is uniqueness, still there is a full-blown quality to each such Gnostic being. And impersonal at the same time. The whole of existence is the supreme being. That supreme being is a person, but it is also impersonal because it is the cosmic projection of supreme qualities, Satchidananda.
So Devajisdham.
Yeah.
So, as we practice on a day-to-day basis, how important is it to be able to integrate all of them into a daily practice? Because one of the problems, like this example of personality and impersonality, for example, or life is yoga. One of the problems that one faces, especially with the integral yoga, is that because it includes everything, it becomes very difficult to exclusively focus on one side of the yoga, because especially when the mind is active, there's always a tendency that other things also come in, that the things that you're not doing also come to the forefront. So how to, is it important to be like, how important is it to integrate everything right from the beginning or to keep things aside for later?
No, you see, your question, it's a complex question. The question is very complex. One aspect of it is this, that at any one time, as we are moving in this yoga, there is a stress to progress in certain directions. That is why when we say, when you ask the question, what is it that we need to do? We have to temper that question with the understanding that we do nothing. That ultimately, in a sense, the Shakti is doing the yoga. Now, I'm not saying that we should only say that, and that's why I said we have to temper the question. Because to say that is also a cop-out. We can easily say that, the Shakti is doing the yoga, I need to do nothing. But the reason it is important to see both at once is to recognize the fact that our agency lies largely in being a receiver. To be open to what is the purpose of Shakti in us. In other words, where is it that the concentration is going at this point of the yoga? I think that is a very important sort of aspect. So there is already a certain selection going on. At any time, there are certain things that are to be focused on and other things that are less important at that moment. Now, as far as the question of personality and impersonality and that kind of thing goes, I think what is really key at any point is two things. On the one hand, the eradication of the ego. In other words, that sense that self-regard, as if I am somebody separate and different from others, and needing to assert myself as something separate, that has to be acted against. And on the other hand, the opposite tendency of trying to completely become quiescent because I am a nobody, that has to be acted against too. One is an instrument of divine forces, and at the same time, one is a person in the sense that there is a certain kind of clear psychic individuality that is the center of one's existence. That center of one's existence is not qualitatively different from other existences. In essence, we are the same being. But nevertheless, there is a center for existence that we cannot just, you know, erase in looking for something which is impersonal.
Yeah, thank you, Devajista. Especially the last part, because what we think of as the personality at the beginning is only the ego, like when we regard it, we think it's a person, it's only
exactly.
The ego. Okay, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that focus, that attempt to differentiate, mm-hmm. That very tricky, you know, hair-splitting distinction, you know,
yeah.
Between what is the ego and what is the person? That is part of the whole idea of the ego, of the experience of progress. One has to keep one's attention on that, you know, to develop in that understanding.
Yeah. Thank you, Devashista.
Ultimately, it is like this, Shyam, I'm
yeah.
thinking aloud,
sure.
You know, a little more. The thing about the disappearance of the ego and, you know, what Sitaram was talking about being a fragrance only,
mm-hmm.
that aspect of the existence of the person. The experience of the person is enjoyed even in oneself, you see, because ultimately, the existence, the experience of human existence is really for the enjoyment of the presence of Purusha, the presence of Shakti, and the interplay between Purusha and Shakti. That those forms of enjoyment are the very basis of the yogic life. Now, therefore, it is not so much I as a person who is clear to my own self-definition, as if I have a mirror about who I am, but rather the ability to be surprised with wonder at the notion or at the appearance or self-presencing of a divine person who is appearing through us. See, somebody is appearing through us, and that appearance is being enjoyed by ourselves. That is the kind of experience that one can arrive at, or that one can, you know, aspire to arrive at, in which the sense of self is replaced by the wonder at the appearance of the person.
Yeah. Thank you, Devashishtha.
Devashishtha, in the trinity of existence, consciousness, and bliss, I was trying to relate basically our existence is more a Purusha aspect, and consciousness is the bridging aspect between the Purusha and Shakti. And bliss as a Shakti aspect. Is it a good way to think about it?
Well, it's close, but actually I would say like this, and our tradition also looks at it more like this, that Chit Shakti is actually the Prakritik or Shakti aspect. Chit or consciousness is the Shakti aspect. Now, what it looks at it is like this, Sat is more like the Atman aspect, Paramatman aspect, Supreme. Chit is more like Shakti aspect, the power of concentration and manifestation of consciousness, of self. And Ananda is more like the union of the two, because Ananda is ultimately in its being is the Purushottama. Is the Supreme Person. See? So, Ananda unites Chit and Sat and Chit as, you may say, self and power of expression of self.
So, when we look at nature, for example, a plant or a hill. Like, basically, it is expressing, it has the existence, it has the, doesn't have, maybe, may not have the high degree of consciousness, so it may not enjoy that much of bliss. So, it has the potential to experience the bliss in existence, but that is the predominant aspect of it. Correct?
Yeah, sure. And on the other hand, I mean, it may not be experiencing the bliss in existence, but you may say that there is an experiencer of the bliss, that is not the mountain itself, but that which gave the mountain form. Everything has been given form, even prior to its own self-experience, by something which is expressing itself. So that is the fullness of the expression of Chit, opening up the possibilities of Sat as forms of Ananda.
Only in the poetic forms, you see the impersonal things were given personal acts, so as they enjoy.
Right. And so you may say what you're calling poetic forms, which are in our way of enjoying, is a shadow of the divine self-enjoyment. See, because the poetic form is ultimately, we may say that the mountain was waiting for the human being to come, and how the sunrise was waiting for the human being to come and enjoy it in a poetic way. But we can go one step further and say that the sunrise was created by the great poet, Supreme Kavi, who created it for the sake of self-enjoyment.
Very nice. Thank you.
Is Alexandria there, which you want to read next?
A supramental Gnostic individual will be a spiritual person, but not a personality in the sense of a pattern of being marked out by a settled combination of fixed qualities, a determined character. He cannot be that, since he is a conscious expression of the universal and the transcendent. But neither can his being be a capricious, impersonal flux, throwing up at random waves of various form, waves of personality as it pours through time. Something like this may be felt in men who have no strong, centralizing person in their depths, but act from a sort of confused multi-personality according to whatever element in them becomes prominent at the time. But the Gnostic consciousness is a consciousness of harmony and self-knowledge and self-mastery, and would not present such a disorder. There are indeed varying notions of what constitutes personality and what constitutes character. In one view, personality is regarded as a fixed structure of recognizable qualities expressing a power of being. Another idea distinguishes personality and character. Personality as a flux of self-expressive or sensitive and responsive being, character as a form fixity of nature's structure. But flux of nature and fixity of nature are two aspects of being, neither of which, nor indeed both together, can be a definition of personality. For in all men there is a double element, the unformed though limited flux of being or nature out of which personality is fashioned, and the personal formation out of that flux. The formation may become rigid and ossify, or it may remain sufficiently plastic to change constantly and develop, but it develops out of the formative flux by a modification or enlargement or remolding of the personality, not ordinarily by an abolition of the formation already made and the substitution of a new form of being. This can only occur in an abnormal turn or a supernormal conversion. But besides this flux and this fixity, there is also a third and occult element, the person behind of whom the personality is a self-expression. The person puts forward the personality as his role, character, persona, in the present act of his long drama of manifested existence. But the person is larger than his personality, and it may happen that this inner largeness overflows into the surface formation. The result is a self-expression of being which can no longer be described by fixed qualities, normalities of mood, exact lineaments, or marked out by any structural limits. But neither is it a mere indistinguishable, quite amorphous and unseizable flux, though its acts of nature can be characterized but not itself, still it can be distinctively felt. Followed in its action, it can be recognized, though it cannot easily be described, for it is a power of being rather than a structure. The ordinary restricted personality can be grasped by description of the characters stamped on its life and thought and action, its very definite surface building and expression of self. Even if we may miss whatever was not so expressed, that might seem to detract little from the general adequacy of our understanding, because the element missed is usually little more than an amorphous raw material, part of the flux, not used to form a significant part of the personality. But such a description would be pitifully inadequate to express the person when its power of self within manifests more amply and puts forward its hidden demonic force in the surface composition and the life. We feel ourselves in presence of a light, a consciousness, a potency, a sea of energy, can distinguish and describe its free ways of action and quality, but not fix itself. And yet there is an impression of personality, the presence of a powerful being, a strong, high, or beautiful, recognizable someone, a person, not a limited creature of nature, but a self or soul, a purusha. The Gnostic individual would be such an inner person unveiled, occupying both the depths, no longer self-hidden, and the surface in a unified self-awareness. He would not be a surface personality, partly expressive of a larger secret being. He would be not the wave, but the ocean. He would be the Purusha, the inner conscious existence self-revealed, and would have no need of a carved expression, expressive mask or persona.
So here, in this long paragraph, Sri Aurobindo gives a more detailed view of this relationship between the person and the personality. And though he doesn't use those terms here, we can see exactly those distinctions between what he has called the psychic entity and the psychic being. On the one hand, there is something which is a person, and this person ultimately goes back to the divine person, the divine as person, the supreme person of Purushottama. Now, this sense of something which is the person, yet the illimitable person, I mean, it is not a person that exists through certain limited characteristics, that he makes that distinction between person, personality, and character. So, beyond the sense of character and personality is the person. And the sense of person ultimately goes back to this divine person who has all these kind of, you know, attributes in totality, measure of totality. Now, on the other hand, there is what is a certain aspect of that person that enters into the play of nature. And in this entry into play of nature, there is the development of a personality. That personality is based on the various nature forces that are utilized by the person for its self-expression. So a mold comes into existence. And that's where he talks about the possibility of an ossification, that is, a certain kind of crystallization or solidification that will lend its limitations to the personality. These limitations, if they are very acute, are what we call character. Character is the predictable behavior aspect of a personality. Now, however, he is talking about the fact that behind this personality, there is something more fluid. And that something which is more fluid is taking the various possibilities of self-expression in nature and creating larger molds through which it can express. So it does not necessarily need to crystallize itself. It can actually become more and more, flexible or fluid in the possibilities of its self-expression. Indeed, this is the reason why Sri Aurobindo explains elsewhere, human beings work through lives in which certain nature aspects are taken up. And then, once those nature aspects have been exhausted in their power of self-expression, there is the movement to another life. In each of our lives, we take other forms of nature expression. And so, the psychic personality develops flexibility as a result, develops greater ability to handle different aspects of nature. Now, he also points out that this is because there isn't a certain sufficient degree of control over the nature by the psychic being. If that takes place, gradually, it is not necessary to cast, to move from one life to another through this, intermediate sort of shedding of nature of a certain life. There can be a greater and greater flexibility which enters into the rebirthing of the personality in a life itself. That causes a kind of an expansion of the possibilities of self-expression of the person in the life. And this ultimately ends up in a certain kind of a condition which he's talking about towards the end. That there is no limited mask of persona, but a certain ability to express oneself under different conditions, which is yet marked by a choice of being. So the person is assuming a certain personality, which personality is not limited, but in a sense still a certain kind of projection of the possibilities of nature from which it builds its self-expression. It's interesting that in this long paragraph, Sri Aurobindo uses that term, demon, which we have had occasion to, he uses it in a few places here and there. But such a description would be pitifully inadequate to express the person, its power of self within manifests more amply and puts forward its hidden demonic force. Uh-huh. The surface composition of the life. And, this term daemon, D-A-E-M-O-N, is a term that is used, and Sri Aurobindo himself kind of points to the fact that it's a term used by Socrates. It's actually in Plato's, descriptions of Socrates, where he talks about how Socrates relied on the daemon. And Sri Aurobindo equates this daemon to a psychic being.
Yeah,
so it's exactly that the power of a person within, the innermost person, is the soul of psychic being, or psychic entity rather, that is expressing itself through the personality as the power of a daemon.
I think it came about 3 or 4 months ago, you mentioned it. I'm not sure if it came in Life Divine, but you did mention that it was Socrates' term for reference to the psychic. Does it come
in? Yeah, there's a few places where he uses that term, and whenever he uses it, I see that reference that he's making.
Yeah. And it is a very powerful paragraph, this one.
Yeah, powerful and complex, mm-hmm. very complex too. Near all in this paragraph, there is this whole notion of the vibhuti that is also floating underneath it, one can say.
Uh-huh. It's 9:34 now, so shall we stop for today and continue next Thursday?
Sure.
So let's end with a brief meditation.